The only thing I want to experience is winning a gold medal.
Sitting on the slopes of potential history.
We hit up to 6G forces.
Where the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
If you can't race yourself, you can't race anybody else.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
Lots to watch over the weekend as the Olympics got underway. Finally, Russia and the U.S. getting gold medals. Russia seeming to dominate skating in the early going, while the U.S. dominating men's and women's snowboarding so far. Much more to come in the Sochi Games, and we wanted to pose the question, how do they do that? The Winter Olympics is a spectacular combination of low-temperature chemistry and physics, athletics, of course, pure guts, and absolute beauty and grace. But physics rule.
The laws of physics constrain all of us. There's only so high, you know, any one of us could jump or how fast we could go down a hill. And to see athletes using technology, using advanced training methods and diets and nutrition, and getting just to the envelope of what's theoretically possible is just a fantastic achievement. As a scientist, it's just phenomenal to see that in play.
That's Eric Goff, our resident Olympics physicist and the voice of our series, How Do They Do That? He's the chair of the physics department at Lynchburg College and author of Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports. And today we begin with curling. It's got two teams, four players each, facing off, sliding their smooth stones across a sheet of ice. The object of the game is to get your stone as close to a circular target on the ice called the house. The curler shoots the stone. Two sweepers literally sweep the ice with special brooms and guide the stone while screaming commands to each other. But under that sliding stone, it's all physics.
What's prepared ahead of time is that they will spray some water on an icy surface, liquid water, and when it freezes, it'll be in the little textured surfaces so that the ice isn't completely smooth. And that actually helps reduce the friction as the rock is sliding along the ice, because the rock can't make complete contact with the ice. There's not like a vacuum seal that's going on. And after the person will push off the hack and get the rock going, then you have a couple of sweepers ahead of the rock, and they will vigorously be sweeping, and they can actually melt a little water layer, and that helps lower the friction as the rock gets on top of it. They will also spin, sometimes one to say four revolutions. You'll see the stone spinning on the way down, and they can actually get it to curl with the help of the brooming, so they can knock the opponent's stones out of the house that way.
And that's what makes it curling. Science has to be in harmony with strategy in this game. Curling is all about brains as well as melting points and pure brawn.
Some people refer to it as like chess on ice. And the idea is, once all of these stones start accumulating in the house, you can knock your opponent's stones out. So you want to get your stones in to maximize your point total and also knock your opponents out. So with just the right amount of broom work and just the right spin and just the right release speed, that stone can come in. Perhaps we've seen knocking two or more of the opponent's stones out.
So forget all the physics. Anyone who does curling, really does curling, knows that it's really a mind game all the way around, through and through. Brady Clark, is that the case?
Yeah, that's definitely the case, John. You know, I would also add that it takes a lot of teamwork, passion, practice. And there's a whole physical and mental side of the game, as well as strategy.
And Brady Clark, of course, is the reigning national curling champion. What is it that you do psychologically to prepare for a curling? Is it a match? Is it a game? What do you call it?
You know, typically it's called a game. And mental preparation requires visualization and being able to perform under pressure.
And it seems to me that in curling, there's less of a concern about equipment than a lot of the other sports where there's equipment obsessions, and much more of a concern about strategy and signaling between team members and really, you know, how you kind of psych out the other team.
Yeah, you know, curling, definitely there is some key equipment. It's not as extensive as a lot of other sports. But those four team members have to all be working collaboratively and communicating. It takes four members of every team to make a shot.
Brady, I want to be a world-class sweeper. What do I need in my gut?
You need drive, and you need passion, and be working out not with just your upper body, but you need to be working out your whole body. big arms certainly are a huge aspect, but you also need a strong lower body.
Now, do you have names for the stone? Do you, you know, kiss it goodbye when you send it off there down the ice? What goes through your mind when you fire away?
You know, I would compare it a lot to golf. And before every shot, you've got a little routine that you do. You know what your objective is for that shot. You know how hard you have to throw it. And you've got a line of delivery that you're trying to deliver that stone. You're also talking with your teammates about what you're aiming to do and what you're looking for them to do. So there's a lot of aspects in the sport. Just like golf, you've got a little bit of downtime before you're about to throw your stone. So you've got a lot of thoughts in your mind. You have to control it. And then you need to be able to slide out in a smooth, consistent way and deliver that stone on the target. And then rely on your teammates to do the rest.
What can you do in curling that would never be permitted on the golf course?
I would say you can yell at your teammates. You know, your teammates learn how to read your signals and how you're yelling and what that means. So a lot of people watch the sport and they say, what's all this yelling about? You're communicating, but when there's three or four other games going on out there, it can be very difficult to hear your teammates, and you're trying to relay information to them, and they're relaying the information back to the rest of the team as well, because the sweepers play an integral role on every shot.
And when it doesn't work out, is it all your fault, or is it just bad breaks, bad luck?
Well, at this level, I like to take ownership for every game. There's always shots that you could have made. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to reset and move on and go back to the training program and figure out what you can improve upon to be the best in the world.
And when your team is like in the huddle there before the gold medal round, do you spend a lot of time talking about, remember, guys, it's the water molecules that are going from a solid state to a liquid state, and we got to get them on our side. You talk a lot about molecules and physics and stuff like that.
You know, we do keep in mind, though, what's going on with the ice conditions, because they do change as you're sweeping the ice, and over the course of a game, the ice conditions are changing. So we actually do talk about that. We just maybe don't get down to the molecular level.
Well, Brady Clark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you'll be watching in Sochi, right?
I will definitely be watching. I will be cheering on our U.S. team and hoping for them to medal.
Brady Clark is the reigning national curling champion. So on this question of how do they do that, let's take speed skating at the Olympics. Monster muscles, sleek near frictionless suits, and long bladed skates. But there's one more ingredient, the ice. We asked our friends at PRI Science Friday to explain how the ice in the Olympic arena is maybe not the same ice that cools your tall glass of lemonade. Joining us is Christopher Intagliata, senior producer for Science Friday. Welcome.
Hi, John.
So I can't use this arena ice for any other purpose than speed skating, right?
Only for skating. You're not allowed to use it for anything else.
And in investigating this, you really have a sense of precision. Mark Norman, who's vice president of venues and sport at the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, someone with experience about this, talks about just how precise the speed skating conditions have to be.
To give you an example, so our 500-meter, our shortest distance, we tend to shoot for a surface temperature of the oval of about minus 8 Celsius. 1,000 meter, maybe minus 8.5. 1,500 meter, minus 9.5. 3K, 5K, 10K, minus 12.
Optimal temperatures for each race.
Exactly. And he's checking all this on his iPad during events down to the tenth of a degree. And the reason that actually matters is because for a long track, you want a little bit of a harder ice. For the short track, they're doing so much scrambling and fighting to get the lead. You want something that has a little bit more give, and that's why you have minus 8 Celsius versus minus 12.
How did he figure this stuff out?
Trial and error. He does a lot of experimenting in the arena. He also experiments with the air temperature. That's something else that we talked about.
And here's one of the ways in which he experiments with Olympic ice.
Well, it's a little bit less dense the warmer it gets, so it's a little bit easier to move through. I brought the building one day up to 72 during a competition. To me, that is where the optimal lies, but the athletes all hated it. It's just too hot. We're sweating. I got these skin suits on. We can't breathe.
And from the perspective of the skaters, they can feel the difference on the ice, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We talked with one speed skater there, Travis Janer, and he gave us his skater's perspective.
There are days where it feels like the ice is awful, and we're like, oh, what's going on? Like, I wonder if they're playing with it, or did the coaches ask them to do it on purpose? Or then you start asking, is it just me, or is it my blades? Like, did I lose, you know, are my blades dull? Or you're always fighting your own demons all the time, and yeah, the ice is a big part of it, but also it's, you know, something that should go unnoticed at the same time.
And this is much more down to the molecular level than, say, you know, juicing the ball in baseball or, you know, putting gook on the bat, you know, to increase the ability to hit. I mean, these are really, really tight tolerances.
Yeah, and I mean, there's weird physics stuff going on at the surface of the ice, and that's not something that Mark gets into. You know, he's not a physicist, but he has, through trial and error and being a former speed skater himself, really honed this down to the perfect combination of what skaters can do and what ice can do. Because in the end, if he makes ice that's too fast, they're falling all over themselves and they don't push their hardest.
And part of the issue is, and you alluded to this a moment ago, is that you need to be able to be almost frictionless when you're speeding. But you also need to get traction when you're trying to accelerate or make it through the curves. That's an interesting tension.
Exactly. And he uses purified water for the long track and the short track. But for the short track, he actually adds in a little city water, just like 1% or something, just to give a little minerals and dirt in there, just to give them a little bit more drag and so they can really push on the ice.
Scientifically, would we expect that the Russians have some, they're doing pretty well in skating so far, have some special ice formula?
I don't know. I don't know about the Russian formulas, but I will say that the guy who took the gold, Sven Kramer, in the 5K this weekend, he actually went 7 seconds slower than his record. And his record was set in Calgary, which is another really high elevation arena, just like Salt Lake City. So Salt Lake City and Calgary sort of vie for the title of fastest ice on Earth.
Christopher Intagliata is a senior producer for PRI Science Friday. Thanks so much, Christopher.
Thank you.